American by birth or not, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says he wants to end birthright citizenship, but he may not have the authority to do that.
The Supreme Court and Congress have an important role to play and, in a sense, will stand as a check, we expect, on the president's executive orders, as he seems to have proposed it.
Jose Antonio Vargas isn't surprised by Trump's focus on immigration ahead of the midterms. The writer has been called the best-known undocumented immigrant in America, but he's still hopeful.
At a time like this, I have to believe in love. I have to believe in the generosity of people. I have to believe that we don't struggle alone.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. If the U.S. is a country of immigrants, it seems the president is determined to change that, from lowering the number of refugees admitted to the U.S., a record low cap under President Trump, to making the lives of migrants coming to this country miserable. Now Trump says he plans to eliminate birthright citizenship. That's the idea that if you are born in the U.S., you are automatically a citizen. It's not clear if he can do that. The concept is enshrined in an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But the president told Axios he could do away with it unilaterally.
You can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order.
Martha Jones is a professor at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights. So this is all tied into the 14th Amendment, and there's an interesting history behind that. Could you talk about what went into forming it?
Sure. The 14th Amendment comes into being in the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War. 4 million plus former slaves are now free people. And the question is, who will they be in a formal constitutional sense with respect to the nation? The 14th Amendment declares them to be birthright citizens. But it goes further, of course, because it extends beyond former slaves to all persons born in the United States, making them citizens of the United States.
So let's talk about that more in a moment, because it's all part of your research. Let's just get into the precedents for what we're looking at today, a prior case that came close to defining or interpreting this from the Supreme Court.
The most important case for thinking about this question is that of a gentleman named Wong Kim Ark, which was decided by the Supreme Court in 1898. Wong Kim Ark is born in the United States. His parents are Chinese immigrants who cannot become citizens of the United States because of the existing Chinese Exclusion Acts of the period. But Wong himself assumes himself to be a citizen because he is born in the United States. He leaves the States to do business in China, and when he returns, he's detained at the port and refused reentry. His case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the court affirms that even as Wong Kim Ark's parents cannot become citizens of the United States, he, because he is born in the U.S., pursuant to the 14th Amendment, is a citizen.
So it seems like the case kind of centered on the parents. Did the outcome at the Supreme Court essentially define birthright citizenship as we know it today?
Well, it did in the important sense that it rejected the view that one's citizenship turned on the citizenship status of one's parents. President Trump now appears to be aiming for those born in the U.S. whose parents are not citizens, Wong Kim Ark is an important touchstone.
I'm just wondering, what's to stop the government from revoking anybody's citizenship? I mean, should that worry us?
What we know is that in our system, ultimately, it is going to be some combination of the Supreme Court, which will decide the constitutional questions related to citizenship, right? Will determine in the end what the meaning of the 14th Amendment is with respect to citizenship. But Congress also has a role to play, whether it's through the regulation of membership of people, say, in a place like Puerto Rico, right? Puerto Rican citizenship is determined by acts of Congress. Naturalization is regulated by Congress. So both the court, the Supreme Court, and Congress have an important role to play and, in a sense, will stand as a check, we expect, on the president's executive orders as he seems to have proposed it.
You know, I think about countries that follow a bloodline. I think of France, nobility. Do you see the U.S. taking that on? I mean, it's not unheard of.
It's not unheard of, but even in France, we have, as I understand it, a hybrid system, right? That being born in France does not extend to one full and enduring citizenship, but a child is presumed to be a citizenship in France until he or she becomes an adult and then is subject to a new set of reviews. That is the kind of thing that people in the U.S. have proposed. Where I would like us to focus is less on the mechanics of citizenship, though that's not unimportant, but to think underneath what it is that we hope citizenship accomplishes for us. In order to have this conversation, I think partly we have to think about what are the values? What is the value of family? Today, that same 14th Amendment that gave former slaves integrity with respect to their families is being used as a weapon or a scythe separating families in our country. In my view, that is not a value sort of consonant with the role that citizenship should be playing.
Martha Jones, a professor at Johns Hopkins and the author of Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, today, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan reportedly said it's not possible to end birthright citizenship via executive order. Meanwhile, President Trump's visit to Pittsburgh is also in the news on the day that the first funerals were held there for victims of Saturday's attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue.
I've been thinking a lot in the past 48 hours about, you know, all those people who happen to be Jewish in my life who made no, there were no hesitation about welcoming me into their family.
That's Jose Antonio Vargas, author of the new book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Vargas was born in the Philippines and has lived in the U.S. without papers since he was 12. Vargas was part of a team of journalists who won a Pulitzer Prize at the Washington Post in 2008. When he spoke with my colleague Rupa Shenoy, he began by describing the role Jewish Americans have played in his life story.
When I got to this country in the early 90s, I didn't really know anything about Jewish people. And especially when I got to high school, there was a family, the Greenstein-Wade family. It was the first time I'd ever had a Jewish friend, but I didn't know what that meant either. And her friend was Natalie. Her name was Natalie Wade, my classmate. And then I ended up meeting her mom, Gail, and Gail's mom, Rita, and Rita's husband, Eli. And then they kind of adopted me into their family. And then when I got to the Washington Post, I was assigned a professional mentor, and his name was Peter Pearl. And he taught me the meaning of the word mensch. I didn't know what that was. And he was the first and only adult at the Washington Post that I told that I was here illegally. And he made a very crucial decision that basically saved my career.
To accept you coming out as undocumented.
Yeah. And I told him everything, the fake papers, you know, everything I had to do to lie my way into a job at the Washington Post. And I expected him to report me to the HR department. Instead, Peter said, "This is now our shared problem. Don't tell anybody else. Just keep going."
Yeah, you describe in the book how you almost have two families, one apart from your actual family, and the family of partially Jewish and other people, they kind of helped you survive while being undocumented. But then at home, your family was frustrated with you for coming out as undocumented, and you were getting these conflicting messages. How did you navigate that?
Well, I mean, a lot of people who grew up in immigrant backgrounds can relate to this, because there's the dynamic at home in our immigrant households that we're told that we shouldn't want too much, right? We should put our head down. Don't make too much noise. We're here to just work, right? We're not here to be visible, to be seen. And yet I had this other family that was mostly from my high school, Mountain View High School, and then Peter Pearl at the Washington Post, who just wanted me to succeed in all the ways that I could succeed. You know, if I didn't have all those people in my life who told me to keep going, right, that these immigration laws didn't make any sense at all, I'm not sure I would have allowed myself to be encouraged and to kind of pursue what I wanted to do.
Why was that an important point to make, that American citizens helped you survive and thrive in this country?
Because when we talk about undocumented people like me in this country, it's almost as if we exist like islands onto ourselves, when the reality is people like me in this country cannot be in this country working, living, surviving, thriving without all those U.S. citizens who help us out at every juncture, at school, at work, at the church. And yet when we talk about immigration, especially illegal immigration, the role of U.S. citizens are actually not much part of the conversation.
We're looking at this quote-unquote caravan coming up from Central America, and the president saying we're not going to let them in and things like that. One thing you did in your book is explain the history up and to the point of your own name and how you ended up being part of a family that wanted to come to the States and how it was influenced by the West. Can you tell that story?
I think that when we explain why people move to America or why migrants are moving to Europe, I think we have a very simplistic way of doing it. In America, which is what I know, people assume that migrants know about the Statue of Liberty or the American Dream. I didn't know anything about that. All I knew was when I was a kid, America was Coke. It was Nike. It was Spam. It was the Hershey's Kisses. It was all the stuff that my grandparents in America, who are naturalized citizens, you know, sent to the Philippines to my mother and I. So American capitalism was there, was very present since I was a kid. McDonald's was there, right? And I think we don't kind of interrogate what American foreign policy and American economic policy, in addition to the wars that we fight, that we fought, what those reasons have to do with why people move. You know, I was in North Carolina a few years ago and I was doing this Tea Party event. And I ended up saying that there are 4 million Filipinos in America. We're the third largest immigrant group. Mexicans, Chinese, and Filipinos. And this man got up, elderly white man, and he said, "Why are there so many of you here?" And I said, "Well, you know, sir, we are here because you were there. The Spanish-American War? My name is a product of Spanish colonialism, Jose Antonio Vargas. But Jose doesn't have an accent in the E because when the Americans took over after the Spanish-American War, their typewriters didn't have accent marks. So my name is a marriage of Spanish colonialism and American imperialism."
Just to circle back to the beginning, we started out talking about the people who helped you become someone and go places where people wouldn't think you'd be able to go, like the Washington Post newsroom. And now we have this synagogue that was attacked, people who did help refugees. I mean, do you think people are still helping young people like you? American citizens are still playing that role? Do you think that's going to change?
Absolutely. They're helping. I know this. I know this because they follow me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and they send me messages. I know this because if it weren't for the generosity of all these people, including Jews who know a lot about homeland and the search for home, if it wasn't for that generosity, I don't really know why the sky hasn't fallen. You know, at a time like this, I have to believe in love. I have to believe in the generosity of people. I have to believe that we don't struggle alone. I would argue that after this horrific, horrific tragedy, I bet you that more people are going to be more willing to help.
Jose Antonio Vargas's new book is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have Rupa Shenoy's full interview with Vargas, by the way, at theworld.org. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. For a platform that was supposed to build community, it's become pretty clear over the past few years that Facebook's communities have some problems. Hate speech, disinformation, fake news. These problems don't just live online. They spill into the real world, and they have serious consequences. Our colleagues at Frontline here at WGBH have spent a year looking deeply at how all this has impacted people all around the world. Their documentary, The Facebook Dilemma, is airing on PBS this week. We want to focus on one country discussed in the documentary, the Philippines, where President Rodrigo Duterte is accused of using a coordinated army of trolls to silence his critics.
We gave it a name, patriotic trolling, online state-sponsored hate that is meant to silence, meant to intimidate. So this is an information ecosystem that just turns democracy upside down.
And where lies are prevalent.
Where lies are truth.
Frontline's James Jacoby worked on this investigation and joins us in the World Studios. Thanks for coming by, James.
Thank you.
What is the place of Facebook in the lives of most Filipinos? Like, how much of the population has access to it, and how much do they interact with each other via the app?
Well, it's remarkable. The story of Facebook in Southeast Asia is amazing in that they pushed aggressively into Southeast Asia, into Philippines, into Myanmar, other countries. And they are essentially the de facto internet in a lot of those countries because they offer Facebook as part of a data plan where people don't actually have to use data in order to use it. And in the Philippines, it's between 90 and 100% of the internet users in the Philippines use Facebook as the internet, basically. And Maria Ressa, who's the woman we're interviewing in the film from the Philippines, who runs a big news organization there, she talks about the fact that it's their public space. It truly is their public space in the Philippines in terms of their digital lives.
So Maria Ressa, we just heard from, we'll hear more from her in a moment. We've reported on the story that occurred in Myanmar where fake news actually led to violence. How did Rodrigo Duterte, the Filipino president, weaponize Facebook during the election campaign in 2016?
So what happened is Facebook actually offered a lot of help to Duterte during his campaign for president and helped him to really harness the power of the platform, helped his campaign really understand how to use it effectively. And as Maria Ressa reports, after he was elected, he essentially weaponized it by turning all this campaign machinery, all these accounts that he was controlling. He had a network of fake accounts and of paid followers that were disseminating all sorts of lies about his policies and also going after critics in a rather vicious, hateful way, and in some cases trying to incite violence against people.
So on Maria Ressa, this activist, I mean, she worked for a prominent news website in the Philippines, Rappler Media. And when she started noticing this problem, she actually brought it to Facebook's attention in 2016, as we learn in the doc. Here's an exchange between you, James, and Maria Ressa.
Were you given an explanation as to why they weren't acting?
No. No. I think Facebook walked in to the Philippines and they were focused on growth. What they didn't realize is that countries like the Philippines, countries where institutions are weak, where corruption is rampant, these countries don't have the safeguards. And what happens when you bring everyone onto a platform and do not exercise any kind of rules, right? If you don't implement those rules beforehand, you're going to create chaos.
So, James, what did Facebook tell you about the way they responded to the Philippines and to Maria Ressa's complaints?
Well, Facebook has said a number of things in response to it. One, they've said they were too slow in addressing the problems that Maria had brought to them. And it wasn't until Maria produced and published a three-part investigative series that exposed the fact that there were these accounts that were spreading hate speech and misinformation that Facebook actually took action on those accounts. But as she tells us, the problem is ongoing. Interestingly, recently, and as I think it was in April, Facebook is paying Maria Ressa's organization to be a third-party fact-checker of things that are going viral on Facebook in the Philippines. But as she put it to us recently, they're completely inundated, and Facebook still doesn't really have a handle on the problem there.
Does that suggest, you know, hiring her as a fact checker, does that suggest Facebook is kind of pursuing due diligence, or they were just trying to plug a hole?
I think that their fact-checking project that they're trying to do all around the world is what they're seeing as the first step toward a solution, or at least containing the problem of hate speech and misinformation, to have people on the ground that are fact-checking material in the home country, in the language. And it's really an outsourcing of it. And what's also fascinating about it is that Maria Ressa runs a news organization, and she's utilizing resources that would otherwise be put toward reporting and doing fact-checking for what's going viral on Facebook.
Yeah. If you zoom out of the Philippines for a moment, I mean, many of us are closely watching Facebook's operations here in the U.S. and abroad. And the big question, which you raised several times, are they doing enough at Facebook to stop these campaigns, whether it's disinformation, fake news, hate speech? What do you think after spending a year investigating all this and actually being at, HQ for Facebook?
Well, it's an interesting question because what does it mean enough? And I asked people at Facebook, you know, what's the standard for success here? Because there's no ability for us to audit them. We're really left in this position of having to take their word for it and whatever it is that the standard that they set for themselves. But there's so much that we just don't know.
But as writer Alexis Madrigal from The Atlantic says in your doc, and it was a really powerful quote, the very things that divide us the most are the things that get the most engagement. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a bit and where that's most evident right now.
Well, we've got our midterm elections and we've had, you know, the horrific events here of the past week and seen that whether it's the shooter in Pittsburgh or the attempted bomber, these are people that are very radicalized on social media. Polarization and filter bubbles are a real thing on social media, and this kind of reinforcement of worldviews, that's the main discussion happening right now, I think.
James, after a year of working on this and investigating Facebook, are you on the platform, or what? If you were, are you now off it?
I'm on it. I've always taken I have a very small footprint on there, which, by the way, doesn't mean much in terms of what data they're collecting
right.
on you. It's just, I'm torn. And Zeynep Tufekci, who's in the film, who's a scholar at UNC, says, I think, one of the most important lines, which is, what are you going to do about the fact that all your friends and family are there? It's this tremendous thing to be able to communicate with people. It really is an amazing invention, but it is so problematic. So what are you going to do?
James Jacoby with Frontline. Part two of the Facebook Dilemma airs tonight on PBS, and you can find part one online at pbs.org. James, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. A top cabinet official from Israel flew to Pittsburgh to offer his condolences. Some Israelis and American Jews didn't like his message.
He should know better, but yet he still found a way to compare the hand that shot down 11 Jews praying on a Sabbath morning to Hamas.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Operation Faithful Patriot, that is the name the Pentagon has chosen for the deployment this week of more than 5,000 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, a deployment ordered by President Trump just days ahead of the midterm elections. The president says the troops are needed to protect the country from an invasion of migrants. He's referring to that group of thousands of migrants from Central America currently making its way north through Mexico. The migrants, by the way, are still more than 1,000 miles away from the U.S. border, and they're not expected to arrive there for weeks. The president's critics are dismissing the deployment as a political stunt ahead of the midterms. So what practically can those troops do? Gina Harkins is a reporter with the defense news site military.com. Gina, the Defense Department likes clear missions. So what is the mission of these troops?
Well, the request actually came down from the Department of Homeland Security. And it sounds like what's going to be happening with these active duty forces is that they're going to be assisting Border Patrol agents on the ground. So they're going to have some military police units, some combat engineers, some aviation support and medical personnel who can assist as the Border Patrol agents, I guess, try to address this caravan as it makes its way toward the U.S. border.
The Defense Department has made clear that these troops will be carrying live ammunition. What's the justification for that?
Well, apparently, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis made that call. And as long as the troops normally carry weapons, they're authorized to do so on this particular mission. Now, it doesn't sound likely that they're actually going to be coming face to face with any of these people. It sounds more like they're going to be assisting the Border Patrol agents in their mission, and they'll actually be the ones on the front lines. So that's a little unclear.
So the president is a commander-in-chief. There's nothing legally to prevent him from doing this. But once the troops get to the border, what legal authority governs what they'll be able to actually do?
They do face some legal restrictions as part of the Posse Comitatus Act. And that dates back to the 1800s, which basically limits troops from carrying out domestic policies inside the U.S. Now, there is some wiggle room in that. U.S. Northern Command, which Department of Homeland Security's call to send these troops down to the border, has some authority to partner with agencies like that when it comes to defending U.S. security interests from inside the U.S.
There are already several hundred National Guard troops on the border. So why didn't the president ask for more guards rather than going straight to regular forces?
That wasn't really clearly addressed during yesterday's press conference, and it's a good question. There are, as you mentioned, about 2,200, I believe, National Guard troops along the border, and they've been in place since early this spring. And those troops are mostly unarmed, and they are also assisting, you know, the customs and border patrol agents on the border. President Trump, in an interview with Fox News last night, made an interesting comment that previous presidents have called up the National Guard, but he's actually called up the military. And it's really one and the same. You know, they are part of the military. So it's a little unclear why President Trump wants active duty forces in place of National Guardsmen. It could be for maybe a political view of it.
The other thing is that critics have been saying is that the deployment's going to negatively impact training and readiness. What have you heard from your sources about that?
Well, I think that is definitely a concern. You know, when troops are in their home bases, they are typically training and they're gearing up for whatever deployment they're going to be carrying out next. Taking them away from that mission and putting them on the border does take them away from, you know, not only training in the field, but also some of the military education that they need to carry out to further their careers and some of their other requirements. So it is a fair point.
Gina, has anyone at the Pentagon discussed how they selected the name of this Operation Faithful Patriot? Because that doesn't sound totally random.
I have not heard anything about how the name came about.
Gina Harkins with Military.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
The midterms and immigration remain top of mind for President Trump less than a week from Election Day. Today, though, he made room on his schedule to travel to Pittsburgh in the wake of the attack on a synagogue there on Saturday. His visit was controversial even before he landed. The rabbi at the Tree of Life Synagogue welcomed the president. There were also protests from some members of Pittsburgh's Jewish community who said Trump was not welcome. We also noticed that the reaction in Israel after the attack exposed some divides between Jewish communities there and here in the U.S. We asked Dina Kraft about this. She's a reporter for the newspaper Haaretz and based in Tel Aviv.
The reaction on the official level was very much, you know, condolences and shock. But there was also a lot of a sense of a tin ear going on. I mean, starting with the chief rabbi of Israel, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, who refused to refer to the Tree of Life Synagogue, a conservative synagogue in Pittsburgh that was attacked, as a synagogue. He said it had some sort of essence of Jewish character, but he would not call it a synagogue.
And why not call it a synagogue?
Well, for the ultra-Orthodox establishment, which he represents in Israel, conservative and reform Jews or Reconstructionist Jews, any Jews that are not Orthodox Jews are not really considered full Jews in their eyes.
So what do you attribute some of these tin ear reactions, as you put it, to what happened in Pittsburgh?
I think it's cynical politics. I mean, you have somebody like Naftali Bennett, who's the diaspora minister officially. He's also a former aide of Netanyahu and now turned rival. And he tries to always play to a base that's even more right wing than Netanyahu's. And he should, I would argue, know better. But yet he still found a way to compare the hand that shot down 11 Jews praying on a Sabbath morning to the same forces that fire rockets from Gaza into Israel, i.e. Hamas, which I think also shows like a disconnect and a complete misunderstanding of history.
Yeah, I mean, Naftali Bennett also got on a plane to Pittsburgh. There was another reaction, too, from the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer. He was on MSNBC blaming anti-Semitism on both the left and the right. He's blaming both sides.
One of the big forces in college campuses today is anti-Semitism, and the anti-Semites are usually not neo-Nazis on college campuses. They're coming from the radical left. So we have to stand against anti-Semitism, whether it comes from the right or whether it comes from the left?
Yeah, I think here, again, Israeli Jews are not following the intricacies of right versus left in America. I think a lot of Israeli Jews, as we know from polls, support Donald Trump. They don't really care so much about his domestic policies. They don't really know very much about his domestic policies. What's important to a lot of Israeli Jews is that Trump supports Israel and Trump supports a strong Israel. So Ron Dermer's comments, I think, perplex American Jews more than they do Israeli Jews.
Dina, tell me a bit about reaction among some of Israel's left-wing politicians to what happened in Pittsburgh.
I would say overall, although there has been expressions of condolence and expressions of shock and of horror, the news kind of quickly moved on here. I think a lot of Israeli Jews don't fully understand the impact this has had on the American Jewish community. They don't fully understand the place of synagogue life for American Jews. They don't understand that for American Jews, the synagogue is a second home. It's a place where kids grow up in Hebrew school, where they hide, as I did, you know, hiding out from Hebrew school in the bathroom with my friends, and a place where you would play and kind of come of age. And that you know, this is a place where people feel at home. And I just want to share a story. I did a lot of reporting about the residents of Pittsburgh and the people from Squirrel Hill. And one of the stories that moved me most was the story of Jerry Rabinowitz. Jerry Rabinowitz was 66 years old. He was one of the 11 people who were murdered. He rushed to the sound of the noise. We don't know if he knew it was gunfire at that point, to go help. And that is when he was shot. And at the memorial in Pittsburgh, people spoke about how he had this interesting custom. During Mourner's Kaddish, which is the Jewish prayer memorializing the dead, and it's said in every single service, he stood up. He always stood up for the Kaddish. And that is traditionally a time when only those who are mourning actually stand up. And when asked, why did he stand up every single time? He said, well, I have no children. So one day there will be nobody to stand for me. So I stand for all of those who have no one to stand for them. And on Saturday, everybody stood up and stood for Jerry in his memory. And I think that standing up and that standing up together is such a metaphor. And I think overall, Israeli Jews and Israelis in general, they don't need a synagogue to give them Jewish community because they have their Jewish community within their own lives. And in a way that American Jews, if they want to find community, if they want to find a sense of solidarity among themselves, that they find it in the walls of a synagogue. And that is another sort of way that Israeli Jews and American Jews, you know, don't connect.
Dina, this tragedy does reveal quite a few differences between American and Israeli Jews. What would you, how would you sum up those differences? Like, what's the bumper sticker here?
Let me think. That American Jews and Israeli Jews are on two very different paths right now. I would say American Jews, for the most part, are liberal. They consider themselves very much attached to their immigrant roots. And because of that, they tend to support rights for immigrants. They tend to very much believe in the tenet that's repeated in the Bible more than any other tenet, which is be kind to the stranger, because you too were once a stranger in Egypt. And so there's this very strong desire to acknowledge that, you know, American Jews have done fairly well for themselves in America, and feel fairly successful and feel very comfortable. And I think that comfort sort of lends them to sort of be more liberal and more open, whereas Israeli Jews still feel under attack. They feel very much sort of the product of sort of a post-traumatic, post-Holocaust world where they look at things very much in sort of a zero-sum game at times, you know, us versus them, whether it comes to Arab neighbors or, you know, threats from within somehow. In Israel, the trends towards sort of like circling the wagons in fear. And in American Jewry, you have a trend sort of towards plurality, Jewish pluralism, openness. And I think you see those divisions coming more clearly now. And this Pittsburgh attack, tragically, in some ways, highlights those splinters.
Reporter Dina Kraft with Haaretz in Tel Aviv. She's also the host of the podcast The Branch. Dina, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
In her life, Ruth Gates earned a reputation as a passionate defender of coral reefs.
When you look at organisms and you look at a coral reef, clearly we're losing more corals than we would hope. And that means that the rates of change in the environment have essentially outpaced the capacity of the corals themselves to adapt.
Ruth Gates died last week at the age of 56, just months after being diagnosed with brain cancer. Longtime friend and collaborator Virginia Weiss says Gates was one of the very first scientists to make the connection between coral bleaching and global warming.
She started in the 1980s, in the very early days when none of us understood what was going on. She was able to show that corals did this strange paling, and she was able to tie it to warming. And at that time, we were just starting to understand what global warming was.
Over the years, Gates became a beloved teacher and an eternal optimist in a field whose future looks grim. Until her death, Gates led a research lab at the University of Hawaii that's trying to figure out ways to help coral adapt to warming oceans. Her friend Virginia Wife says she was also a regular and vibrant public speaker.
I will remember her ability to light up a room and make everyone in the room feel like she's talking just to them. She had this wonderful, silky, highbrow English accent that she joked was her secret weapon. And she was able to tell the story of corals, and she was brilliant at it. She really excelled at it.
I know you've described her as an iconoclast in her field. Why?
So she was an iconoclast in a couple of different ways. The best one to think about right now is this idea of assisted evolution of corals. It's very controversial. It's the idea that humans need to help corals evolve faster to be able to tolerate the heating that's happening. And some scientists really think that that's not our place to do that. But others, led by Ruth, really feel that we need to try a variety of options. She's the first to admit it may not work, but if you don't try it, then we can't know. But personally, I feel very strongly she was an iconoclast in terms of the way she approached science. She disliked pushing your colleagues aside to get ahead, and she was much more about cooperation and encouraging all diversity, brown people and women. And because of that, sometimes she ruffled feathers, but she ruffled feathers to make the world of coral science a more inclusive, cooperative place.
Such determination to help these coral reefs in the face of, in the past few years, several major coral reef bleaching events. And the rest of the news isn't good. I mean, coral reefs are expected to be almost completely destroyed in coming decades. And yet Ruth Gates remained so optimistic. How did she retain that optimism while studying something so depressing?
Well, it's such a great question, Marco. I think all of us are trying to bottle that, especially in light of her loss. She just looked forward, and she felt like, you know, we can throw our hands up and give up, or we can look for solutions. And I think her enthusiasm really instilled that same passion in a lot of other people.
What is the one memory, Virginia, that you'll always hang on to about Ruth Gates?
Her laugh. You know, she was not a big person, but she had this huge laugh that filled the room. People in restaurants would turn around and stare. I mean, just, and she laughed early and often, and it was infectious.
Virginia Weiss, a biology professor at Oregon State University and a longtime friend and colleague of coral researcher Ruth Gates, who died last week. Virginia, thanks for telling us about Ruth, and our condolences to you.
Thank you so much, Marco.
George Martin, Linda Eastman, Billy Preston, Yoko Ono. If you're a Beatles fan, you recognize all those names as people who were in the band's orbit. Here's another name that doesn't get mentioned a lot, Klaus Voormann. He was a 22-year-old in Hamburg, Germany, when he first saw and met the Beatles there. Voormann later played bass for the lads as solo artists after the band broke up, for example, on John Lennon's Imagine. I first encountered the name Klaus Voormann on the cover of the Beatles album Revolver. Voormann designed and created the black and white ink and collage cover, a psychedelic clue to the music on the vinyl. Recently, I got a chance to speak with him, since Voormann, who now spends his creative energies on the visual arts, has a gallery exhibit that opened just yesterday in Los Angeles. Klaus Voormann, what was it like working on that album with the shadow of the Beatles' breakup so close by?
Well, to me, there was no shadow, because I knew each member really separately. I did not see them as a unit in those days, because it was gone. You know, the whole magic of Beatles was gone, which people didn't really realize, because I saw the inside and I could see that those people just couldn't stay together forever.
So Paul McCartney was the bass player for the Beatles for so many years. Was it liberating for you to come in as the new bass player on Imagine, or was there any psychological baggage that came with that?
I never thought of it. Plus, my bass playing is so different, and it fitted to what John wanted to express, so I never thought of it.
I just want to ask you one more thing about the Imagine sessions. The title track, the song Imagine, was finally co-credited to Yoko Ono last year. John Lennon said at one point before he died that at the time he took sole writing credit because, according to him, I was a bit more selfish, more macho. I sort of omitted to mention her contribution, referring to Yoko. I don't want you to kiss and tell, but what did you see of John Lennon at that time that suggested he was more selfish or more macho?
Yes, he was. And I actually think it's right that he gives credit to Yoko, because most of the things he's done in those days were really very much coming from him and Yoko. Those two were a unit, and a great unit. And it's only fair that he gives credit to Yoko.
So these were the immediate post-Beatles years when Imagine came out and was produced. I want to swing back to their roots a decade earlier in Germany, because this is kind of your story now, Klaus Voormann. You and your friends kind of caught the Beatles. You saw them when they were just an unknown Liverpool rock and roll band playing in Hamburg. Were you making music yourself when you saw them?
When I was a kid, I played a lot of classical piano. That was my musical background. But when I saw rock and roll and I heard rock and roll, I never thought that I would eventually be a bass player and play. It didn't even cross my mind.
What did you think when you saw the Beatles for the first time in Hamburg?
Well, I thought it was so amazing that those young kids, I mean, they were completely unknown. And Georgie was just 17, and he was just lovely. You know, he was lovely, cuddly. John was great, like everybody knows, and Paul was fantastic. And Pete Best was playing the drums in those days, and Ringo wasn't around.
This was post-World War II Hamburg. I know there was a U.S. military base nearby, or an Allied military base, rebuilding Germany and Europe. Remind us, though, why Hamburg had this lively rock and roll scene in the 50s.
Well, you see, Liverpool and Hamburg, they're both seaports, and you have sailors, you have ships. So the kids in Germany, when you went, for example, to a fairground, you heard rock and roll music. So it was eventually necessary that they had rock and roll music live, and that was a great idea of this Koschmider guy who was the boss in the Kaiserkeller and the Indra. But that's the first two clubs the Beatles played in. So he got those bands from Liverpool over, and the kids were coming and wanted to see the band.
Klaus Voormann, what do you listen to these days when you want to listen to music?
Listen, it's completely different. I can easily listen to Glenn Gould playing Bach. Or, yeah, just the other day I got out an old cassette where you got Larry Williams and and all those rockers on it. I still like to listen to it.
You know. Do you still play the bass yourself?
No, I don't.
Why not?
There's nobody around here which I would want to play with. You see, I'm spoiled.
I mentioned your fantastic work on the Beatles Revolver album, the artwork, the pen and ink drawing and collage. Do you still paint? Do you still work in the visual arts?
Well, I actually still do graphic arts, and I love doing it. And I just have an exhibition which now is going to come to Los Angeles. And this is a really great event which is going around, which started in Hamburg, and now it's going to go to L.A. It's a very, very good year.
Klaus Voormann, I'm going to put you on the spot here with one final question. We know your name from the Revolver album, Concert for Bangladesh. George Harrison calls you out along with Jim Keltner. But I don't know what you look like. Can you tell us what you look like today?
Let me see. Maybe a little bit Kris Kristofferson, but I don't look as tough. I look a little more delicate, I would say. I've got gray hair. Sometimes I wear glasses, but most of the time not, only if I have to read something. And I'm thin, and I'm 176 centimeters high.
All right. So, yeah, a fairly tall man.
No, that's yeah. That's normal.
No. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you doing that because it yours is a name that I've known for a long time. Now I feel like I've put an image to it. Klaus Voormann, thank you so much for being with us. It was great to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Concert for Bangladesh, Klaus Voormann was on that gig. His exhibit, It Started in Hamburg, is on view this week in Los Angeles. Check out some of his art and a video of Klaus playing with John Lennon at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.